Chapter 12.
Bathawi System, Galactic Alliance Frigate, Shamanar. The door into the command center slid open, and the admiral, a paunchy, middle-aged man, who nonetheless looked commanding in his white uniform, entered, flanked by two junior officer escorts. One of them called out, "Admiral on the bridge!" Shamanar's commander, a stocky Deveronian, leapt up from his chair and saluted.
"Admiral Klauskin, happy to have you aboard."
Klauskin returned the salute, his gesture as crisp as his uniform. "Captain Bjork, good to meet you." He shook the captain's hand and glanced around the bridge. "We need to speak in private."
"At once."
Bjork led the admiral through another door into his private office, which was decorated in shades of deep brown and tan. Rather than take his customary chair behind the desk, he stood by one of the two doors in front of it and gestured for the admiral to take the other. Klauskin sat, and, as Bjork seated himself, handed the captain a data card.
"These aren't exactly orders," he said, "but authorization for you to take my verbal orders. Shamanar has been detached from ordinary fleet activities and assigned to the Galactic Alliance Guard on a special assignment."
"Sir, I don't understand. Shamanar's current assignment is anything but ordinary. We're coordinating all the Alliance's reconnaissance and fighting forces in the Bathawi system, and we're charged with preventing the Bothan fleets from secretly leaving the system. Our assignment is strategic and important."
"It would have been if you hadn't been betrayed."
That caused Bjork's spine to stiffen.
"Betrayed how?"
"The GAG has been assigned this mission because certain portions of the military have been compromised," Klauskin said. "Not too surprising in a time of war, of course. I've spent the last several weeks on special assignment, ferreting out traitors and planning a response."
Bjork had heard that Klauskin had been hastily removed from his command of the task force at Corellia a while back. There had been rumors that he had experienced some sort of breakdown, but any sudden reassignment of a commander was likely to spawn such rumors.
"Here's the situation," Klauskin continued. "Several of the officers under your command are actually in Bothan employ. On the day the Bothans decide to send their fleet into action, they're going to do whatever it takes to keep Alliance forces from discovering that fact. Until too late. But we're not going to let that happen. You'll supply me with a list of all officers under your command, and I'll indicate which ones are the traitors. We'll reorganize their duty shifts to leave each of them unobserved and unprotected at specific times, at which point we'll capture or eliminate them. Then we, by which I mean Shamanar, we'll take the observation zone they would have been covering. We'll plug the hole their absence leaves."
"Understood. But, sir, I know many of these officers very well. They're not traitors."
"I'm sure the ones you personally vouch for are completely loyal. When you give me the list of officers, be sure to indicate which ones you're certain of."
Klauskin leaned forward to give Bjork a sympathetic clap on the shoulder.
"I know this comes as a shock, son, but we'll get it straightened out very quietly, and it won't reflect on your service record."
"Thank you, sir."
Drua, Moon of Almania. Ben spent the better part of 2 days planning his trip to Zeost. In that time, he performed his credit card stealing technique twice more, and was pleased to discover that it became easier, smoother, and less detectable each time. He did do some planetary database research to find out whether any shuttle carrier or excursion service made trips to Zeost. The answer was a definite, unequivocal no, since Zeost did not appear in any public database. Still, its coordinates were in the files Jason had given him. Nor was there, as far as he could determine, much smuggling activity here. There was nothing to suggest that desperate shipowners, as his Uncle Han had been so many years ago, lurked in every tavern, willing to take aspiring young Jedi wherever they needed to go. Well, then, he'd just have to steal a vehicle. He knew that wouldn't be as simple as sneaking onto some flight line, jumping into a B-wing, and taking off. Vehicles had security codes that made stealing them difficult. Security around the spaceport was not exactly lax, but neither was it set up to deter a Jedi. The chief danger of detection he faced lay with the small security droids used all across the base, half the height of a human, spindly, with conical head sensor packages atop a humanoid arms and legs arrangement. Scores of these droids wandered individually across the spaceport environs, sometimes hiding in the thrusters of hangared vehicles, sometimes riding on the backs of luggage delivery vehicles. Ben watched them for an hour or so through the viewport in the waiting lounge outside the secure areas, and noticed that they did not react to people wearing the bright yellow jumpsuits of spaceport personnel. That knowledge made it easier. A touch of Jedi telekinesis kept doors from closing and latching firmly behind port personnel entering secure areas. Ben wandered through, eventually finding a locker room and helping himself to a jumpsuit and the corresponding transponder that kept security droids from paying attention to its wearer. That gave him the freedom to walk around the port for a day. He still kept well away from most human personnel. They might ask questions about an obviously off-world teenage boy doing what looked like a thorough inventory of all craft on the base. But droids were no longer an issue. It didn't take him too long to find the craft he thought best suited to carry him to Zeost. It was an old Y-wing starfighter, carefully maintained, its hull paint unscarred. It rested beneath an environment blanket covered by a thick layer of dust. The hangar's door computer listed the owner as Hamalian Barkid of Drua, and indicated that his last flight with the Y-Wing had been a half-standard year earlier. A little time on the planetary net tracked down personal data for Hamalian Barkid. He was an employee of Trang Robotics, and messages to him were now being forwarded to Kuat. Clearly, he had been assigned off-world and left his personal vehicle behind. The Y-Wing's astromech was nowhere to be seen, and its weapon systems were dismantled and missing, probably due to local ordinances about private citizens having lasers, ion cannons, and proton torpedoes. But its hyperdrive was intact, and the little glow on the control board Ben could see through the cockpit canopy made it clear that the computers were charged, probably diagnostics running on a battery. And this, at last, told Ben what he needed to do to get the Y-Wing operational.
"In the field, when you can't do something yourself," his mother had told him once, "your obvious solution is to find someone who can do it for you."
He downloaded contact information for Hamalian Barkid into his datapad, then spent several more hours searching on the planetary database for more information he needed and letters like the one he had to write. Carefully, doggedly, he extracted a fact here, a sentence there, and ended up with something that, to his eye, seemed authentic. "From Hamalian Barkid, account 7543, BH, Hangar 113, to Hangar Manager, Drua Spaceport. I will be returning home tomorrow. I'd really like my Y-Wing to be ready when I get there. Please do a power-up, standard maintenance check, and astromech analysis of the computer, particularly the nav computer, and bill at your standard rate to my account." It was that last part that Ben thought would sell the spaceport managers on this task. Everyone said that people loved doing last-minute tasks at their standard rates, because last-minute standard rates were always 3 or 4 times what standard rates would be if arranged in plenty of time. Ben sent the message from the hangar door computer, which could plausibly have received and relayed the message from the real Barkid. He took his pocket holocam, the one he'd been carrying ever since his mission with Jason to Adumar, and affixed it to the rafters, pointed down at the Y-Wing's security access panel, then made sure it would accept commands transmitted from his datapad. Finally, he restored the environment blanket to the top of the Y-Wing, smoothed out the dust as much as he could, and made himself a hiding hole behind some discarded plasteel crates to wait. It didn't take too long. 3 hours later, the hangar door rolled open and two shapes entered. A female human mechanic in the standard yellow jumpsuit, and an R2 astromech. Ben's heart sank. He'd assumed, based on how automated things were around here, that an operation as simple as a routine vehicle check would be handled by a mechanic droid. He'd planned to wait until the droid was finished with its task, and then cut its head off, preventing it from leaving with the R2. But he couldn't cut the woman's head off. Well, technically he could, he just shouldn't. Though if it came down to a question of doing that or failing in this mission, an important mission, what would he do? He frowned, struggling with the answer. The woman, 30-ish, muscular, dark hair up under a yellow cap, swept the environment blanket off the Y-Wing, sending a tremendous amount of dust into the air. She immediately began sneezing. Her R2 unit tweedled at her. As the airborne dust reached Ben, he felt like sneezing too. He held a finger under his nose and scowled at the woman. As the woman moved up to the cockpit, Ben activated the holocam. The R2 unit tweedled again, spinning the dome-like top portion of its body around, its sensors obviously searching for something. Ben crouched further, as if it would make him even more invisible.
"Don't be silly, Shaker," the woman said. "What do you bet the owner has anti-theft sensors set up? We probably set one off."
Mollified, the R2 unit tweedled again and returned its attention to its companion. In a matter of a few minutes, the woman punched her security code into the cockpit side panel, raising the canopy, and then used the hangar's magnetic winch to lift up the astromech and lower it into its berth behind the cockpit. Ben watched as she undogged side panels along the Y-Wing's fuselage and plugged her own oversized datapad into them, one by one, checking readings as she went. As the R2 went through its own series of checks and analyses, the woman left the hangar for a few minutes. She returned behind the controls of a small fuel tanker and proceeded to refuel the starfighter. Anxiety began to grow within Ben. The woman and the astromech had to be reaching the end of their duty. Soon she would be removing the R2 from its housing behind the cockpit. Ben needed to decide right away what he was going to do about the woman. Well, he certainly wouldn't cut off her head, but he would have to incapacitate her. When both she and the R2 unit were looking away, Ben leapt up into the rafters, made his way to where his holocam was strapped, and retrieved it. Then worked his way over to a spot directly above the hangar door and waited. When it seemed that both woman and droid had their attention fixed elsewhere, he dropped silently to the permacrete and used that momentum to roll outside the hangar. Then he walked right back in again, datapad in hand. The astromech was still behind the cockpit. The woman was now readying the refueling vehicle to be driven away.
"Hello,"
Ben said. The woman looked him over.
"Hello. Aren't you a little young for a port worker?"
"Trainee."
Ben made his voice sound sullen.
"All I'm good for is delivering messages, I guess. And I have one for you."
"Go ahead."
"The owner of the Y-Wing says his astromech went through a messy programming breakdown and is having its memory wiped. So he needs another one temporarily. He'd like to rent whichever one was used for the vehicle's computer calibration."
She wiped her hands on a rag and shrugged.
"So why are you telling me?"
"So you can leave the droid here."
"Oh, he's getting here that soon?"
Ben nodded. She looked back over her shoulder at the droid.
"Looks like you get to go tootling around the solar system for the rest of the day, Shaker. Lucky rotter."
She tossed the rag aside and returned her attention to Ben.
Got the authorization code for that?
She retrieved her datapad from the refueling tanker's front seat and held it toward him.
Right here. Prepare to receive.
Then Ben scowled at his datapad.
Stang! My screen light's gone out. We have to do it in the sunlight.
With a sigh, whether for the reliance of others on inferior devices or for the inconvenience of having to walk 10 paces, Ben didn't know, the woman headed toward Ben and the door out. He led the way and turned left past the door, stopping when they were just out of sight of the R2 unit. In the second he had available before the woman reached him, he took a look around. The closest person he could see, a jumpsuited worker, was at another hangar more than 50 meters away. That was good.
All right, the woman said. Transmit.
Ben pressed a button on his datapad, though he'd switched the device off.
Transmitted. Anything I need to do to prep the droid? Just take the restraining bolt off, and I'll do that. Hey, I didn't get the code.
Scowling with pretended annoyance, Ben pressed the button again.
How about now? No.
He stepped closer and was now within arm's reach of her.
One more time,
he said, and drove his fist into her solar plexus. Her eyes got big. All the air went out of her in a painful-sounding oosh, and she involuntarily bent forward. This time he struck upward, an open palm blow that caught her on the chin. He felt her jaw break under the impact. She went down as limp as a cloth bag full of bantha fodder, her datapad clattering against the duracrete beside her. He felt bad, even nauseated, for a brief moment. Then elation replaced that feeling.
There, he told himself. Not too much damage.
Jason would have forgiven me if I'd killed you, and I didn't even do that. Moving quickly, he hoisted her up to a sitting position, then drew her up and onto his shoulders, a basic rescuer's carry that all Jedi apprentices were taught. He carried her around to the side of the building, into the narrow alley between two hangars, and laid her down there. Then he went back to the front of the hangar, retrieved the woman's datapad, and got behind the controls of the refueling tanker. In the few moments it took him to familiarize himself with the controls, the droid tweeted at him.
"Everything's set up," Ben assured the R2 unit. "She's doing the last details and asked me to move this."
He powered up the vehicle, then carefully backed out of the hangar and immediately parked the tanker where it would block any line of sight on the unconscious woman. He had a stroke of luck then. The woman had apparently opened her datapad to the job file for the task of maintaining the Y-Wing. All the data he needed, including full maintenance specifications for the Y-Wing and data on the R2 unit, was there. So he was whistling when he returned to the hangar. He used the woman's own tools to remove the restraining bolt from the droid.
"I'm supposed to take the Y-Wing out on a test flight," he told the R2. "That way, if it blows up, the owner isn't inconvenienced."
The droid whistled and chirped at him, its musical tones suggesting that it was indifferent to the change in plans, but more than happy to go.
"Good. Let me get my backpack, and we can start the pre-flight checklist."
Corellian System Exclusion Zone, Errant Venture. In the first few days after Errant Venture was authorized to ply its trade for Alliance military personnel in the Corellian system, its casinos and other entertainments did great business. Booster Tarek, the grand old man of the operation, though he was theoretically retired from day-to-day duties, was often seen in the casinos, flitting around in his hover chair, greeting patrons and encouraging workers, his eyes alight in the way that only commerce could make them. His new unpaid workers didn't hurt things either. Iella and Miri worked as dealers. Iella wore enough makeup to disguise her true identity. Miri did not need that precaution, but did change her hair color with spray-on hues and combinations each day, just because it was her custom. Two attractive women a generation apart, skillful conversationalists and card handlers, they drew good-sized crowds at their tables each day, and their tips were grand enough to make Miri wonder whether intelligence was the career she wanted for herself after all. Lando and Han worked the casinos too, but not as dealers. Each day they set up in different casinos at sabacc tables. Lando maintained his Beskat Ofterman identity, and Han continued to put on his yellow-skinned, thin mustache makeup each morning. At the end of each day, they compared their winnings. After the first week, Lando was slightly ahead. Mirax spent most of her time with her father. During years of retirement on Corellia, she had cheerfully ignored her father's efforts to bring her to the errant venture to learn and perhaps take over its operations. Now her homeworld was for the time hostile to her, and she had nothing to do more suited to her talents, so she threw herself into these new studies with typical Mirax obsessiveness, delighting her father. Leia, Wedge, and Corrin concentrated on the data interpretation side of things, seldom venturing into the ship's public areas. Each such trip, however short, would cause them to have to don disguises. They confined themselves to an auxiliary computer cabin provided by Booster, and began meticulously assembling and analyzing the data the others provided them. Data came from the drunk patrons and the sober ones, from the happy ones and bitter ones, from the officers with marital problems and straying eyes, from the personnel with accumulated resentments and inadequate filters between their brains and their mouths. The most valuable data often came from patrons who, at the end of their rest and recreation leaves, were dead broke and too drunk to stand. The special circle of errant venture employees took care of them, letting them sober up in quiet little lounges, giving them enough credits for a return shuttle flight to their military units, assuming they hadn't bought round-trip fare in the first place, which often they hadn't, and even half-carrying them to the shuttle docks for their outbound flights. Han, Lando, and the other data-gatherers became new best friends to an immense number of young soldiers, pilots, and technical personnel. But the information they farmed was frustratingly tenuous. 1 week into their operation, the data-gatherers assembled to see if there were any informational gemstones to be found. "I say we start with you," Lando said, pointing to Wedge. "You look unhappiest, and that means results." Wedge did look surly, and the look he shot at Lando did nothing to diminish that impression. "Unhappy, yes," he said. "Results, not really. Seal is here today, gambling in the Maw Casino."
Seal, Wedge's eldest daughter, was a pilot with the Alliance forces, and Lando felt a rush of sympathy for Wedge. To be so close to her, yet unable to approach her, all for the silly little reason that he was technically regarded as enemy personnel. Then Wedge added,
"With a boy."
Lando snorted.
"A boy? What, 12, 13 years old?"
Wedge's glare did not waver.
"About her age, and a pilot. There are two types of male pilots. Good men, such as the ones I never tried to break or run out of my squadrons, whom I would shoot before I ever trusted them with my daughter, and worse men, whom I would shoot if I caught them looking at my daughter."
30 seconds in, Corrin said, and we've already strayed from our topic. War, right? People are still interested in war and puppet masters?
Wedge sighed and turned his glare onto the tabletop.
I know this is going to sound strange, Leia said, but I haven't found any indication that this war was precipitated by outside forces. I've been reviewing news reports, historical analysis, all the data we have on hand, and it looks like the central conflict between Corellia and the GA was the inevitable conclusion of their respective political directions.
"Fewer syllables, please," Lando said. "Remember, your husband is at the table."
Han gave him a faintly amused "you're next" look, then turned his attention back to his wife.
So that means no puppet master?
She shook her head.
It means that war itself is not the puppet master's original plan, or at least not his fault. But the manipulations we think we've detected do add up to something. We can see a cause-and-effect relationship. We just have to figure out the motive.
Iella opened her datapad.
Events like the Corellian ambush of the GA fleet that came in to intimidate it. The outcome? Corellia remained independent a while longer. If it hadn't, another world would probably have become the focal point of the independence movement. Bathawi or Kaminor would be likely candidates, but Corellia had something they didn't.
Wedge nodded.
Center Point Station. And a secret assault fleet.
Correct,
Iella said.
Then we have Admiral Klauskin, who pretty clearly was meddled with, if we're right that these Force ghost manifestations are evidence of our puppet master. The result of that interference? The situation here was worsened. The Alliance was cast in a bad light. Corellia received a lot of sympathy.
Speeding up the process by which other worlds considered coming in on Corellia's side, Leia said. Then, the whole thing at Toriaz Station, the death of Prime Minister Saxon, it caused a change in Corellian leadership, permitting Thrakken Sal Solo to boost himself from Minister of War to President. And with war preparations accelerating, he had to put his secret fleet on the resources list.
Her voice quiet, as though she was hesitant to speak up in this exalted company, Miri said,
"It also scattered the Jedi."
Leia frowned.
"What?"
Miri looked uncomfortable.
"Well, it didn't scatter the Jedi, really. I mean, the Jedi Council on Coruscant wasn't affected. But if you look at family ties, which have made so much of a difference over the years with the Solo Skywalker extended family, one minute you were all together, and then, boom, you were scattered across the galaxy, some of you at odds. It was like a secret grenade."
Leia and Han exchanged a suspicious look, and Iella regarded her daughter with interest.
"That's an interesting interpretation,"
Leia said. Her tone suggested caution, reserve.
"I hadn't considered that as a factor."
Miri, her idea not having been shot down by the accumulated aces, began to look more comfortable.
"At school, we were taught the follow the principle. Follow the money, follow the lover, follow the resources. The trick is sometimes in identifying the resources."
Corin had been nodding ever since the first follow the left Miri's lips.
"You're saying the Solo Skywalker clan is a significant resource, and that it has been eliminated?"
"Yes."
Leia wasn't able to keep a little anger out of her voice.
"We have not been eliminated."
"Not as individuals, no."
Corin gave her a sympathetic look, but didn't yield.
"But as a family, tell me that you can send out a call, as you could have done 6 months ago, and focus the attention and skills of your entire family on a single problem or enemy. Tell me that."
Leia thought about it, then seemed to wilt just a little.
"I can't."
"You've been taken out of the picture, as a united force."
Corin gave Miri a little nod of respect.
"Good work, girl."
"Thanks."
Miri seemed both pleased and uncomfortable with the praise.
"So maybe we assume that breaking your family into pieces that don't fit together anymore was one of the Puppet Master's major goals. Because in the long run, if recent galactic history is any evidence, that will make a big, big difference."
"And you've got to put that clan back together again," Lando said.
Han couldn't keep the pain from his face or his voice when he said,
"I'm not sure it's possible. I'm not sure some of the pieces will ever fit together again."
"Lando's right, though."
Leia's expression became set, determined.
Han, we've been concentrating on the wrong things. Proving our innocence. Figuring out which of Durgegen's cronies need to go down when he does. None of that is really important. Not compared with fixing things. I think we need to give up on the Corellian conspirators.
At least, Wedge interrupted, until the war trials.
Right. Give up on the conspirators. Relegate the puppet master to secondary importance and concentrate on solving the real problems, putting the Skywalkers and Solos back into play as a united front.
Sure. Why not?
Han offered a crooked smile. All Luke and Mara have to do is get themselves exiled, too. And then we can cruise the spaceways as one big, happy family.
But something in his eyes suggested he had left something unsaid. And Lando was pretty sure he knew what it was. Except for Jason. Dozens of decks below, a small cargo craft rose into the main hangar bay of the Errant Venture. It wasn't a pretty vehicle. About 40 meters in length from bow to stern, it had a front end, its main cargo hull, that was as elegant and aerodynamic as a thick nerf stake cut into a rectangle and stood up on its edge. Behind that, constituting about a third of the length of the craft, was the maneuvering shaft, a low cylinder housing the main thrusters and the servos that positioned the maneuvering fins, long wing-like surfaces that stretched laterally from the shaft. In short, it looked like the mutant offspring of a bird and a brick, re-engineered by Verpines to fly backward. This example of the YV-666 line had dents, blast scars, and rust patches all over its hull, making it especially unlovely. At the forward portion of the top deck, Captain Uren Levent carefully maneuvered the awkward craft up into the hangar, then followed the glowing spherical droid above a trail of blinking lights on the hangar floor to her assigned berth.
"Soon as we land," she said, "you'll want to get into the smuggling compartment. They'll do a basic scan from outside."
"We understand."
Alima's voice came from a patch of shadow, impenetrable by ordinary sight, at the back of the bridge.
"Why do they care if there are undeclared passengers?"
"It's all money."
Levent set the craft down with only the faintest of thumps, though that noise was joined by the squeal and creak of durasteel components settling. She grimaced at the noise.
"If they don't know about you, they can't charge you for, well, anything. Soon as I get my cabin assignment, I'll comm you where it is."
"Good. Why this ship, Captain? What is so special about a gigantic casino and shopping complex?"
"It'll take too long to explain now. But remind me sometime to give you my speech about Corellian smugglers."
"We will."
Levent didn't see the shadow fade, but the bridge seemed to brighten, and she knew Alima was gone. 3 stories below, hangar workers came forward. In a moment, they'd be plugging into an exterior hull-com port and asking which of their many overpriced services she wished to avail herself of. Refueling, de-rusting, painting, transmission of the latest holodramas. She waved and smiled down at them as if she didn't mind their presence. And she wished that the Errant Venture would be where they found the Solos, so she could leave Alima Rar and her craziness behind forever.